what you are about to receive, may the Lord make you truly thankful.
Amen!
Please, sir, I want some more.
What?
Please, sir, I want some more.
More?
Catch him!
Snatch him!
Hold him!
Scold him!
Pounce him, trounce him, pick him up and bounce him!
Wait! Before we put the boy to task, may I be so curious as to ask his name?
Oliver!
Oliver, Oliver.
Never before has a boy wanted more.
Oliver, Oliver.
Won't ask for more when he
knows. A witch, an orphan, and the Phantom of the Opera walk into a bar. The bartender says, "What the fuck?" The orphan says, "Can we use your restroom?" Last Wednesday night, Alex announced that he would like to go to Las Vegas. I went over the pros and cons of the city as I saw them. One of the largest cons, besides Celine Dion and iodine-filled shrimp, on my list was the barrage of people who stand outside the casinos smacking flyers against their palms and sticking them in front of your face. I refer to those people as soulless, inbred pieces of shit. This week, I call them colleagues. When Zuzu called me and said that a company wanted to pay me $20 an hour to dress up as the Phantom of the Opera and hand out flyers, I thought, well, I didn't think anything. Little green dollar signs flashed in my eyes. My dick got hard, and I began to drool. This is clearly a sign that I need to reconsider my career options. On Thursday afternoon, I listened in on the conference call of the damned. Dozens of people from around the country who, like me, had chosen to sell their dignity in order to play dress-up, called and asked ridiculous questions of the incompetent managers running the promotion. When the managers felt that they had distributed all the appropriate knowledge to us lonely peons, they deigned we could hang up the phone. One of my boneheaded colleagues shouted, "I'm San Fran Phantom 2004 on AIM! I am me!" I considered donating some of my pride to him, but I know he'd only abuse it. The night before day one of the promotion, Zuzu had called me because she had news, which I had to assume was prefixed with a silent bad. I took the last train to her house, my humble abode circa 2000, and then again circa 2001. After some pistachios and chai, she gave me the first half of the bad news. Chuck the incompetent, what can you expect from a grown man who goes by Chuck, had told both men in the promotion that they would be the Phantom of the Opera, the other guy being a 75-year-old man, the other character in the promotion being Oliver Twist. Now, for the benefit of mankind, I was willing to concede that of the two of us, I should be the one dressed as a 12-year-old orphan. So, I put on the torn shirt, ripped corduroys, green neckerchief, and paperboy hat. When I lived in the house with Zuzu, her husband, and their son, the neighbors gave us lots of dirty looks. More than a couple of people believed that we were having some sort of sordid swinger life. I can only imagine what these neighbors were thinking when they peered through the windows at 3 a.m. and saw Zuzu in a big wig and a house dress feather dusting while I wandered around the kitchen dressed like a 12-year-old orphan. The next morning, Chuck called to give us moral support. He called Zuzu's house and told us how stupid the people from the California promotion were. He called the other half of our team and told them how stupid the Chicago people were. He also mentioned how hard it was to cast the New York show, what with all the black people replying to the ads.
"You can't have a black Phantom of the Opera. That would be like a gay Oliver."
The promotion was scheduled to start somewhere in the city at 9. At 11 or so, we all met in a parking garage, introduced ourselves, and walked out into the public eye. Actually, we walked into auditions for the fucking real world. Picture two men and three women dressed in Broadway show costumes weaving through hundreds of 18 to 24-year-old reality TV hopefuls. There were a few catcalls, and yes, by putting on ridiculous costumes and walking the streets of Boston, we sacrificed a bit of our dignity. You can make fun of us for that, sure, but while we were losers for pretending to be someone else and getting paid for it, if your narcissistic ass gets a part on the real world, you'll be branded a loser just for being yourself. May you all get stuck on road rules, trailer trash. From the very beginning of day one, I got all kinds of flirt play, mostly from fairly hot-looking women, but from a few Broadway geek gays, too. I was returning the flirt to one such boy when I noticed this really sleazy-looking Skeletor standing in a puddle of his own drool. He limps over to me and starts talking to me about how much he loves musicals, and he's really happy that young men like myself were able to make money acting in musicals. Whatever, freak. After a few seconds of me obviously trying to ignore him without being so obvious that I drop character, he asks what high school I go to. Ugh, look, you middle-sighted pedophile. I'm not at all flattered that you think I look young enough to be in high school. I felt like calling over one of the cops that was in the area and asked them to beat him with their nightclubs or at least get him a new prescription for his quadrifocals. I haven't looked like a teenager since I was 11. The rest of the day was smoother than a drag queen's upper lip. People loved us. Hordes of tourists demanded to take pictures of us and then took flyers by the handful. Not one was thrown on the ground. We headed to the Boston Common, where, in addition to the tourists, a Waffle House of stoned college students took flyers while we were all serenaded by a homeless man dressed as the Cat in the Hat. The second day began the badness. Being smarter than the coma patient who dreamed up this promotion, I suggested we head to the theater district and hand out flyers about a Broadway-themed television show to the people who were paying top dollar to go see Broadway shows. This is why they pay me the big bucks. Unfortunately, it took literally hours for us to find parking in Boston on a Sunday morning. While the women searched for parking, this isn't sexism, two of the women have cars, and none of the men have driver's licenses. Grandpa Phantom and I headed to the Wang to pass out flyers. We were quickly told to disperse. When we met up with Zuzu, the witch, and thoroughly modern Millie, we decided to hit up some high-traffic locations that we'd avoided the day before. On the way there, we made a return trip to the Common. This time, instead of flocks of tourists, there was a mob centered around one of the park bench areas. The Phantom and I were leery of the mob, so we stood back while the women folk began pestering them, and that's when I noticed the cross. So did Zuzu, and so did Millie, both of whom backed off immediately. But meanwhile, during a moment of silence for the homeless Christians of Boston, a woman in a witch costume was handing out flyers for a television show. Oddly, no one was struck by lightning. Other highlights of the day included being waved into a senior citizen home where all of the residents took pictures and flyers, and getting free advertising by the duck tour staff who took flyers and pointed us out every time they drove past us, making sure to note the TV show we were promoting, and when it airs, go Ducks! On our way through the North End, we encountered some sort of hockey team who took pictures with us. After the photos were taken, I handed one of the ugly monkeys a flyer, which he refused. He said, "I don't watch no Broadway shows." Much the way a hooker will tell a cop, "I don't suck no dick for crack money." Around 2 o'clock, we headed toward the Opera House, where the Lion King would be getting out. Unlike those assholes at the Wang, the lovely staff at the Opera House were more than happy to allow us to hand out Broadway-related flyers to the people leaving a Broadway show. Right around the corner from the Opera House, a mob of people with cameras and iPhones snapped hundreds of pictures of us and took hundreds of flyers. They were there to take pictures of the Yankees leaving their hotel room. And so it was that a mob of Yankees fans, Red Sox Nation, the audience of the Lion King, and 5 soulless TV promoters shared the same block in Boston, Mass. We gave out 10,000 flyers in 30 minutes. They had given us 5 days to give out 15,000. I should, at the very least, get some sort of bonus for my genius pass-out flyers in the theater district idea. I won't. Chuck would probably say something like, "I hope you didn't give any tickets to the Gooks or the Spicks. They don't like Broadway shows." Now, we had a conundrum. We'd signed up for 5 days of work handing out flyers. In 1.5 days, the tickets were all gone. We decided as a group to call Chuck and ask him to send more tickets, hinting that we might need more, not letting him know that we were finished with the job, so Chuck mailed us some more tickets. For whatever reason, we were forbidden to work on Monday, further proof that Chuck belongs to some weirdo cult for the creatively challenged bigots of the world. So this morning, the witch, the phantom, Millie, Zuzu, and I met in the pouring rain to hand out flyers in malls. This is, by the way, completely against policy in every mall in America. Incompetent Chuck and friends had not arranged any place for us to go in case of rain. I knew, having done my tour of duty as a mall worker, that handing out flyers on their property was going to get us in trouble. Once again, I came to the rescue. I harassed the very nice folks at Borders and Barnes and Nobles, all of whom were overjoyed to take stacks of flyers from us. Still, we had been contracted to hand the flyers out on the streets, so, in my two-size, two-small orphan shoes, I trudged through the rain where angry suits, aging valley girls, and the sort of black-eye-lined, cutting pseudo-goths whose email addresses likely include the words bitch, pain, or vindicated, refused to take flyers. There are 5 common moves used to avoid getting flyers. Move 1 is the no-eye-contact flyby. I approve wholeheartedly of this approach. You don't want the flyer or your time wasted. I agree that you have a right not to talk to me, hot and charming as I may be. Move number 2, the two-handed cell phone approach. This says that you would take a flyer, but your cell phone is so heavy that you just can't carry anything else. This is usually accompanied by a shrug. Move 3, the head shake and grimace. Kind of like the no-eye contact flyby, but with a fuck you for interrupting my very busy day of molesting children and stealing from the poor cherry on top. Move number 4, feigned interest. You listen to the spiel, ask questions, then leave without taking a flyer. Have you nothing better to do? I don't. If I did, I'd be doing it. Either take a flyer or go back to your job at Starbucks. Move 5, arm-waving hostility. This is accompanied by screaming and moral outrage. Luckily, none of the promoters in my group were the recipient of move number 5. But while we were in Harvard Square in the wind and rain, we were interspersed with people trying to get donations and volunteers for John Kerry and a similar group for George Bush. One poor sap asked some liberal-looking guy if he'd like to donate to Kerry. The guy got really indignant and began waving his hands and screaming, "I've already given $500 to the Kerry campaign and $500 to the Democrats, thanks to this ridiculous McBain law." His ignorance, not mine. "I can't legally blah, 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 blah. Why can't you guys give me a pin or something so you know that I've done all I legally can? Stop harassing me. Blah, 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 blah." While he ranted, I asked the pro-Bush people for a stack of flyers and stuck them in the man purse the guy was carrying. At the end of the day, wet, sullen, burly, blister-footed, I dragged myself to Twitara's, a bar where I have on occasion met my prospective publisher. I hoped she would see me in all my raggedy glory so she would be inspired to either speed up the publication check-cutting process or at least see the limits I was willing to go to get material for my next book.
"If I should say he wasn't very greedy, I could not, I'd be telling you a tale. One boy for sale. Come take a peep. Have you ever seen as nice a boy for sale?"
You might imagine the phrase, "I came back from Christmas dinner to find 3 half-naked Chinese boys in my bed," would be the beginning of the happiest, filthiest story I have ever told. But the truth is, I was exhausted. I'd spent 4 days snowed in Cranberry Lake with my mother and her boyfriend, who had spent the majority of the time arguing. All I wanted to do was sleep. But when I'd arrived at my tea stop, I was told my usual bus was not running, but there was another bus that ran via Broadway. Because my Food in the Rent apartment is just off Broadway, I got on said bus, which spent approximately 45 seconds on Broadway, and then detoured to Antarctica via Middle Earth. I had to take the bus all the way back to its point of origin, and then drag my heavy, wheel-broken suitcase over the iced sidewalks 2 miles to my apartment. The food in the rent has come at a price. My room in the apartment is the size of your average closet. There is room for a bed, which is somehow smaller than the uncomfortable futon I had when I lived in Burlington, Vermont, as well as a television and a computer desk, which is not big enough to hold both the television and my laptop. Fortunately, while Alex is in Las Vegas, he gave me permission to stay in his room with a large, comfortable bed, which, unfortunately, appears to be filled with 3 half-naked Chinese boys and not sleep. The 3 half-naked Chinese boys appear to be as in shock about my existence as I am about theirs. Hey, I say to the landlord, there appear to be 3 Chinese guys sleeping in my bed. In Alex's bed, actually, the landlord says without looking away from his computer. Well, I was under the impression that since your previous tenant is still in the room I paid you for, and Alex is in Vegas, that I was staying in his room for the month. I did sit down with you and Alex and thought we had all agreed to that. Oh, certainly, he says, creepily smiling at me. But you were away for a few days longer than you told me, so I didn't know when you were coming back. Which has nothing at all to do with anything that we're talking about. I got snowed in while visiting my mother. I'm back now, though, and I'm exhausted, and all I really want to do is sleep. Well, he says, still smiling away, I met those 3 boys at Logan, and they're just in town for the week, and they were going to be staying at some hotel, but since there was no one using Alex's room, I told them they could stay there. But, I inhaled, I am using Alex's room. Right, but I hadn't seen you. You could have called and asked me when I was coming back, I said. Alternately, smiling wider now, he says, you could have given me an accurate time frame for your trip. There was a blizzard. They declared a state of emergency. It was on every channel. Oh, he said, I don't watch the news. I prefer to read the paper. Which you didn't get because of the 3 feet of snow that fell the other day, right? He smiled wider. He now had only smile and eyes. His nose was lost, somewhere between his upper lip and lower lids. Right. Silence. I need them to get out of the room so I can get some sleep. Okay, what time should I wake you up for dinner? We're planning on eating around 7. The landlord is obsessed with everyone eating together. It is becoming clearer and clearer that while food is included in the rent, sanity and personal boundaries are not. I'm not hungry, thank you. I'm just going to sleep. During our discussion, the 3 half-naked Chinese boys put their shirts on and moved into the living room. I go into Alex's now empty room and collapse directly into a coma. I wake up to a commotion around 3 a.m. It sounds like someone's moving furniture upstairs. I put my headphones on and return to sleep. The next morning, on my way to Zuzu's, I see Sylvester, one of the Chinese boys, sitting on the front steps smoking.
Your uncle is creepy.
My what? I ask. Do you mean the landlord? I'm not related to him. I'm just renting a room.
Oh, well, we're going to a hotel tonight.
He takes a long drag and squashes the butt out with his foot.
I didn't sleep a wink last night.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I say. It sounded like someone was rearranging all the furniture in the frat boy's room. Sorry, he says. That was me. The landlord told us that one of your roommates would be away, so 2 of us could stay there and the other could sleep in the living room couch. I said I'd sleep down there because Brian snores, and anyway, at like 3 o'clock in the morning, I wake up, and some fat guy is sitting on my fucking face.
What?
Some fat guy in a robe fucking sat on my face. I had to push him off, and he didn't even apologize or act like it was weird that he'd sat on my fucking face. I'm assuming the fat guy is the pill popper who was supposed to move out last week, but who is still in the room that I am paying rent for. So far, my only interaction with him was in the kitchen, where he alternately referred to me as Mark or Jonathan, and regaled me with stories of his youth in Provincetown, going on and on about clubs that, as someone who's worked in Provincetown, I know, have never existed. I found our conversation really frustrating, but now that I have a frame of reference, I would much rather be lied to by someone calling me the wrong name than have them try to use my face as a sofa cushion. So I went upstairs and I pushed the dresser in front of the door so that he couldn't break into the room. Jesus. Really has nothing at all to do with the conversation. I'm not sure why I keep bringing him up. Sorry, that's fucked up. Yeah, so hotel tonight and no more following smiling strangers home from airports. That sounds like a good rule in general, I say. Well, it was nice meeting you again. Sorry for the craziness. I spend most of the T-ride to Zuzu's evaluating my living situation in my head, and most of the night at Zuzu's discussing it out loud with her. My phone rings around 10 o'clock. Landlord. Hi, Adam. How are you? I'm okay, I say, spending some time with a friend. What's going on? Well, he says, there was some unfortunate chaos last night. I could actually see him smiling through the phone, and I had to ask Francis, the face-sitter, to move out. During our discussion, James, the frat boy, decided that he no longer wished to stay here. So, I'm calling to let you know, when you get back, you can move into your room. Alex will be back in a week or so, and I'll find someone new for the other room. Sounds great, I lie. I'll see you tomorrow. And after a pleasantry exchange where I envision his smile swallowing the entire house, I hang up the phone. The next morning, I move all of my belongings into my pencil case-sized room and head downstairs to make myself a sandwich. There's a Korean guy in the pantry. I don't mean on a shelf or lying in a pool of blood on the floor, just a Korean guy I've never seen before, rearranging the pantry shelves. Hi, he says. Hi. Oh, I see you've met Simon, the landlord says, walking into the pantry and putting his arms around Simon's waist. I met him at the airport yesterday. He'll be staying here for a few weeks. Why the fuck is this guy in the airport all the time? Does he stand near the baggage terminal with a sign that says free lodging for hairless Asians? Are you the new tenant? I ask. The landlord giggles. No, he stays in my room. The two of us are headed to line dancing class in an hour if you'd like to come with us. I don't dance, I say. Oh, I usually don't either, he says. But this class is all gay men. It's a great opportunity to gather, talk, and touch each other. I see. But if you gave me something sharp, I could probably blind myself so I wouldn't have to see that image ever again. Adam, you know your living situation is completely insane, right? Celeste asks when I call her to have conversation with someone at least moderately reasonable. Celeste and I met through poetry a few years earlier when Wiz and I were living with a psychotic, sword-wielding painter named Peter. Celeste was going to an art school down the street from our house. For a while, she would drop over unannounced to hang out. Then, one day, we met her for drinks at Twitara's and walked back to my place to play a rousing game of Kingdom Hearts when we heard the noise. Well, I was very familiar with the noise. Celeste's eyes widened in horror. Dude? It sounds like someone in your neighborhood is getting murdered. No, that's not what it sounds like at all, I say. Wow. So, your neighbors are having some really amazing sex, then? I sighed. Those aren't my neighbors. Indeed, you could hear Wiz and Dee having sex for approximately 7 blocks if the wind was blowing the right way. Celeste began calling ahead when she wanted to hang out. In the last year or so, we've been spending less and less time together. She'd finally gotten a job at a coffee house, and Wiz, Dee, and I had first moved to Cambridge, and then I'd moved out of their apartment to Somerville, into the apartment which, she's right, is completely insane.
At least it's near the good times, she says. Want to meet for pizza?
We've been doing beer, pizza, and Street Fighter night twice a week for nearly a month when Celeste says,
so, I know you like working at Kookaburra Canyon because that hot guy who's never going to let you fuck him again works there, but the coffee house I'm working at is, like, desperately in need of some dudage, and it's way closer to your new apartment.
Let me think about it, I say. The next night, I'm watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer in my room and eating a fantastic plate of spaghetti. When the show ends, I walk downstairs to wash my plate. Simon takes it from my hand.
I'll do that for you,
he says. I can do that, I say.
It's okay. I like cleaning things.
He lets out this oddly wistful sigh, moaning sound while he scrubs my dish with a sponge brush. I have to get out of this house.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying. Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty. One thing I know is true, you'll be dead before your time is due, I know. Watch my daddy in bed and crying, watch his hand been turning gray. He's been working and slaving his life away, oh yes I know.
Finished listening to the In Safe Mode podcast, Laughing in the Abattoir, Part 4, Flyer Monkey, brought to you by Kevin Spack, who claims to have once accidentally been in a musical. Intro music for this episode was Oliver from the original Broadway soundtrack of Oliver. Incidental music was Boy for Sale from the original soundtrack of the Broadway show Oliver. Outro music playing now is We've Gotta Get Out of This Place by the Animals, who, as far as I know, have no connection to Oliver. I wish I could say the same. If you have any questions about my writing or just want to read more, you should check out www.crookedtreehouse.com, or you can email me questions at insafemode@gmail.com. Such questions may include, how was Kevin Spack accidentally in a musical? Maybe if you ask the right questions, we can finally have the answers we deserve.
Somewhere, baby. Somehow.
Baby, I know it, baby, you know it too.